Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic podcast. Today, we're joined by journalist and author Peter Hitchens, and Mail on Sunday columnist. We're also joined by Adrian Pabst, Professor of Politics at Kent and Deputy Director for the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. It's a joy to be here.
And we're all feeling the joy on this rainy Wednesday morning, as we're in the lacunae between tube strikes. And we're here to talk about Ukraine, how we got here, and where we should go. So I'm going to begin with turning to Peter and ask, how did we end up here? Who's to blame? Always the journalistic question.
Well, we ended up here as a result of extraordinary folly. I think largely to blame of certain lobbies, mainly in the United States, which believed that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States could become a single world power, and thought that one of the essentials of this was to keep any kind of revival, any kind of Russian revival from happening, regardless of whether Russia was remotely resembled the Soviet Union, which had been beaten and had collapsed, and pursued this mistaken policy with relentless determination, and have now got what they wanted. You've presumably heard of the Wolfowitz Doctrine, which was first set out, I think, in 1992, in which this idea was set out. It's absurdity itself. When you look at the history of the time, it's quite obvious that the major challenge to the United States as a world power has not been Russia, but China.
Looking the other way. Just for the sake of our listeners, and not for me, who've actually heard all about it, could you just say what this doctrine is?
Well, that the United States should, from now on, always be the only world power. And as part of this, this originally came out of Elite in the New York Times, which then toned down official document. Paul Wolfowitz was, I think, an undersecretary at the Pentagon. That to achieve this, one of the things that was necessary was to prevent any kind of real resurgence by Russia. And so this came from the same stable that the Iraq War eventually came from, which gives you an idea of its genius. And the idea didn't really seem to have all that much importance in 1992, when in the late 1990s, Bill Clinton decided to back the expansion of NATO against the very strong advice, particularly of George Kennan, probably the most expert diplomat and Soviet there ever been. It came alive again. There's a nonsense talk now about how all the new members of NATO begged to join, but they could have begged their heads off if the United States Senate hadn't voted for NATO expansion, I think, 1998, partly because Clinton was keen on it, and also partly because American arms manufacturers had lobbied the Senate very heavily to vote for it. And that was the start of it, and it's gone ever since. And people, there's extraordinary disparate numbers of people have warned against it. It's the only cause which I think has ever brought Noam Chomsky and Henry Kissinger together on the same side. Robert McNamara, even, and Yegor Gaidar, one of the most prominent liberal democratic politicians in Russia, all of them said, do not do this. One of the things that they specifically warned against was that it would stimulate the growth of a militant nationalism in Russian politics, which would lead to trouble. They couldn't have been more right. I've seldom seen a more accurate prophecy in politics, history, or diplomacy come true so quickly.
So Western triumphalism after the end of the Cold War, and then Western hubris in the run-up to Iraq was a major, major factor in creating the conditions for everything that's happened. And I think at the same time, it's also the case that successive Russian leaderships have not really been very clear as to what it is that they were pursuing. Were they pursuing the status of a European power? Or did they really want to go down the road of a more Eurasian outlook that would somehow position them separately from both the West and China? And I think that is part of where we are, that the Russian leadership isn't really clear as to what it wants. Richard Nixon in 1994 asked a really interesting question, which was, who lost Russia? And I think the answer to that is, I think, both the West and Russia. clearly the way that we introduced capitalism through shock therapy in the late 80s, early 90s was an absolute catastrophe, creating gangster capitalism, you know, a mafia state, and all of that again underpins much of what was happening in Russia today. And I think the other thing is Russian institution nation building, clearly with Yeltsin, did not really take root. There were incredible democratic movements. Peter knows much more about them than I do, since he was in Moscow at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, it didn't really take root, and we didn't collectively help Russians build the institutions and the sort of nationhood that I think would have withstood the more authoritarian tendencies that have now prevailed. So I see this as a combined failure of the West and Russia. Absolutely clear that Russia's security interests were not properly taken into account and dismissed, and Russia felt humiliated. But also, I think the Russian leadership really sort of oscillating between wanting to be a European or a Eurasian power.
So in terms of how we got here, and I'm interested, you know, you can say that NATO, you know, play devil's advocate for a moment here. You can say that, okay, perhaps the West helped create resentment in Russia, but is there also a sense of inevitability here that in the collapse of the Soviet Union, the return of old Russian ambition is always going to happen? Is it perhaps better that we expanded early rather than late?
No, I don't think that that follows. But I think the question that was already raised in 1890 and then discussed at the Paris conference that gave rise to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which itself built in Helsinki, which was the most important diplomatic agreement to avoid nuclear war in Europe in 75. Then the question was what European security architecture should be built in order to protect the countries that felt threatened by Russia, whether during Soviet times or indeed going back further in history, on the one hand, but also how do we bring Russia into the security architecture after the end of the Soviet Union and, of course, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact. And all the principles agreed upon in Paris have not really been followed through. And I think they haven't been followed through on both sides. I wouldn't say it's just one side that is to blame here. Russians like to ask the question in the crisis, who's to blame? It is probably a universal question, but I would certainly say it was very much a shared blame in the 90s.
I don't think that's true. I think there's you cannot presume that things would have happened this way anyway. I think a huge amount of Western agency. I concentrated on the NATO issue in my first reply, but the other thing that is quite obvious is that the economic, particularly, approach to Russia, and the ridiculous assumption that if you impose the outward trappings of democracy, elections, and supposed political parties, without in any way building a civil society, were just acts of folly, and also they were cheapskate behavior. When we defeated Nazi Germany in 1945, we recognized on the space left by it, we had a chance to build something and very successfully created a society which, well, by no means a perfect democracy, has adversarial principles in it, has real political parties in it, has a genuinely free and independent press, and very quickly developed traditions of tolerance which have stood the test of time. All that could have been done, and it could have been accompanied by an equivalent of martial aid, which was not done. And the other thing which happened as well as the general catastrophe of oligarch capitalism was that people came to associate a so-called democracy with corruption and the loss of their livelihoods and of their homes. And democracy became a swear word to many Russians and has been ever since. And the other thing is, we became very censorious about Putin later on, but we were extraordinarily tolerant of Yeltsin's behavior. This is a man who actually brought tanks up to Prospekt, my street, to open fire on his own parliament building. And what happened? Nothing. He savaged Chechnya just as much as Putin has done. Nobody gave a damn. His re-election was pretty much bought, as far as Ivan Yeltsin's go, with foreign money, and nobody minded about that. Now we pretend this tremendous concern about the Russia which resulted from this. The real reason why we let Yeltsin get away with murder was because he allowed us to rape his country.
So if we feel that NATO has helped set Russia up for failure, how much of that, I'm interested in particular this economic angle, has so that after World War II, you know, the economic orthodoxy of the day was Keynesian, it was the idea we're going to build up these economies. Is Russia, in a sense, a victim of neoconservative economics as well as neoconservative politics?
Well, it's a combination of neoconservative crusades and liberal interventionism, as well as the sort of shock therapy and neoliberal capitalism that we exported. You know, famously, the Chicago boys that traveled to Moscow to tell them how to restructure their economy, with absolutely catastrophic consequences, plunging millions of Russians into poverty and thereby creating enormous popular resentment about the sort of westernization they've been embarked upon. I suppose I would add to that the problem of you know, the paradoxical nature of Russian statism, which, you know, looks very powerful, but often is actually incredibly brittle, you know, sort of in terms of institutions. So you might have a highly centralized political system, but a lot of the institutions across the country are weak and ineffective. So that even if you wanted to build up local democracy, you know, local economies and get a sense of, you know, regionalism, which is what certainly the Constitution tried to enshrine and up to when Yeltsin tried to promote, it just hasn't taken root. And I think it's that failure of institution and nation building I was alluding to earlier that I think contributes to the rise of authoritarianism, you know, at the end of the 90s and ever since.
I think there was very little understanding among most Western people about how much damage had been done to Russia by the Bolsheviks. I still stand in amazement. My first week in Moscow, I went to see a film by Michael Stanislav Gavrikin, an old friend of Solzhenitsyn, called Tak zhit nelzha. It means roughly, we can't go on living like this. And it gives a very, very honest account of the corruption, incompetence, immorality and general total societal failure of the Soviet Union as a society, which the Politburo had, to its credit, allowed to be shown in cinemas. And everybody in the cinema around me was weeping because for the first time in their lives, they were actually hearing the truth spoken about the society in which they lived. And that film, to my knowledge, has never been shown on any Western television station or any Western cinemas. People simply have no idea how bad it was, and they just thought it's an advanced industrial country which has had communism and has Russians in it. They didn't begin to understand what a slum it was and how low the starting point was either. And that constantly was my, as a London colonist, I have no real conception of these, but traveling around the Soviet Union at that period, if you happened, the train was delayed and you went through big industrial cities in daylight, this enormous great piles of rust and desolation, you could see that this was an economy which had already collapsed, in some cases almost a moonscape. And the idea that just a little bit of injection of capital and some entrepreneurial pizzazz was going to transform it was what is, I believe, politely referred to in Whitehall's round object.
And I think we can add to that you know, some more things. So obviously there was the invasion, occupation of Afghanistan, which also ended up sapping much of the morale of the military and other sections of society. And then, of course, a withdrawal that was also seen as a humiliation, you know, on a much greater scale than, of course, the humiliation the West suffered when it withdrew from Afghanistan last summer. And then there's other things as well. So, you know, the Soviet system from the outset, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution was profoundly anti-Russian. It destroyed everything that had made the country, the village, the church, the monarchy, you know, the whole Tsarist system, and not just the regime in terms of, you know, the politics, but the fundamental structures of society were utterly destroyed. And in that sense, yes, the Soviet Union was a form of Russian domination over other republics, and of course Russian language and so on, but it wasn't just a story of Russia expanding to these parts. It was also the destruction of the old Russia and replacing with something utterly new that most Russians didn't want. Yeah. Hence they rose up against
one of the most fundamental things that destroys the middle class. There was a nomenclatura, but there wasn't the proper middle class, there wasn't the proper professional intelligentsia, there was nothing like that to step in when the rule of the party faded away, and nothing to be on the basis, for instance, of a proper system of justice. The rule of law, it remains totally absent, nothing to resist with any kind of moral force the power of corruption. There's nothing there, it's the vacuum into which all kinds of horrible things go flying.
Yeah, I think the criminality is an interesting question when we're analysing Russia. That I think people don't realise, I think, just how much of the old Soviet economy was, by the end of it, black market. I think some estimates were something like, 20% of GDP was made up by activities that were technically illegal by the end of it.
The society of that nation fosters corruption, and everything was corrupt, and the Communist Party structure itself was full of corruption, and those people were very well placed when communism fell, to move into the new Wild West economy and be much more spectacularly and successfully corrupt than they'd been before.
Yes, and I think what we've sort of seen over time, sort of in the 90s and then in the 2000s, sort of, patrimonial fusion of wealth and power, where wealth, is a condition for power, and power isn't wealth seeking, but power gives you also access to wealth, again, as a guarantee of power. So it's a really, really sinister fusion. And in that sense, the sort of gangster capitalism that emerged in the early 90s has just been sort of taken over by the state, but still operates. And that's, I think, fundamentally why corruption happens and is so corrosive, including in the military.
And they get hostile to the growth of an independent middle class, which is the basis, I think, of any proper civilized country.
I'm interested then also how this fuels the current conflict. One thing I think people may not always realize is that Donbass is quite an important industrial region that emerged in the Soviet Union.
Less so now.
But the legacy of that was that there is actually quite a powerful mafia that operates in the region, which has connections to the Russian state.
Well, I think you'd find that there would be corrupt organizations. Perhaps I think the word mafia dignifies these rather unpleasant groups of people. They don't have the sophistication of the Corleone family. No doubt that plays a role in practically every region of Russia. And I should point out here that when you talk of Russia in this case, you're also in many cases talking about modern Ukraine too. The similarities between the two groups, that Russia has oil and gas and Ukraine doesn't.
So, turning us then to the present conflict, do you think that NATO expansion is the reason that Putin is in Ukraine, or do you think that it's a merely contributory factor?
Creating the conditions in which this has happened. Putin took his decision himself. He's responsible for it. It was an evil decision, and it was also it was worse than a crime. It was a mistake from his own point of view. There's no point trying to even attempt to remove responsibility, but the conditions in which he was able to take this appalling decision were, in my view, created by the people who pursued NATO expansion and the isolation of Russia and the prevention of Russia from reviving.
I think at the very least, it's given Putin and the Russian leadership an ongoing pretext. That at the very least we can say. There is something else, which is, of course, for some years now, really since his return to the presidency in 2012, Putin has made it very clear that he sees Russia as a civilization state and one that is Eurasian rather than European or Asian. So he's clearly made that decision that Russia is a Eurasian civilization state. And here, again, the problem is the huge tension and contradiction between a civilization and a state. You don't usually associate civilization with statehood, right? Most civilizations at some point will be crossing borders and will not be contained by a single state. And that is the peculiarity of the Russian civilizational state, that it's both a single state that then has sort of fluid borders. And also there's this conception of the Russian world that's associated with it. So it's both a civilization state and a kind of world or even cosmic view. And that, I think, just creates lots and lots of contradictions. And the pursuit of that, I think, in Ukraine is essentially to say, you know, much of eastern Ukraine all the way to Kiev is part of the civilization state, or should be. And I think that's also underpinning it.
Very small point here, which your dad is familiar with. The Russian, the principal Russian right for security or safety, which used to be part of the title of the KGB, is Birza Peznost. And it's a negative word. Birza means without. Birza Peznost means without danger. Therefore, the Russian concept of security is a negative one. It's the default state of Russia is fear and danger. One of the most attractive streets in South Moscow, Ulitsa Bacha Ordinka, near the Tretiakov Gallery, is called the Street of the Great Horde. Mm-hmm. And it's called that because it's where the Golden Horde used to turn up every few years to collect their tribute. And this is a reminder of the fact that Russia has been repeatedly and ceaselessly invaded and sees that as a normal condition of life. And being a Eurasian state, of course, also raises the question, we never mention this, because what could we do about it anyway if we did? But Russia has another constant and growing threat, which is its eastern regions are strongly desired by and threatened by China. And China will eventually find some way, I think, of getting them back. And any Russian leader who has concerns for his country in mind will think of that quite a lot. The European end is pretty bad as well, but the Chinese end is going to cause trouble too. It's a country in some difficulty, and one with a declining population, a lot of them quite ill, and an economy roughly the size of Italy's. It's got difficulties.
So, I mean, given that's the case, should we be less worried about Russia? I mean, is this the kind of the last act of kind of Russian megalomania before another collapse? Or
I think their fears could be justified. I think if this Ukrainian adventure goes as wrong as it could go wrong, and there are many, many ways which could go wrong in the short and long term, then it could be the end for Russia as a major country. And I think that whether that's a good or bad thing would possibly depend on whether you were Russian or what other attitude you had towards civilization. But it seems to me that there is a genuine danger to the integrity of Russia, and one which I think was set out by Zbigniew Brzezinski when he pointed out that the creation of an independent Ukraine more or less neutered Russia as a major power.
I think absolutely. There's first of all the terrible bloodshed in Ukraine, and it's very clear that is not going to be forgotten by not just people there but elsewhere, which will then lead to further expansion of NATO with Sweden, Finland, and other countries desperately joining because they're so afraid of a Russia that will always be a neighbouring state just by the sheer law of geography, and so that creates enormous tensions going forward, and they will not be resolved until we have a security architecture that somehow protects all the countries that are afraid, but also acknowledges Russia's security concerns that Peter has already mentioned. The fact that Russia has been invaded from any, part of its, or from, from all parts of its geography throughout its history, whether from the east, with the Mongols, from the north, the Vikings, all the way through to, to southern attacks as well. So there is no way we're going to live in security if we only have one organization that doesn't also acknowledge Russia's security concerns. But of course, it requires more fundamentally, a sense that Russia isn't a threat to its neighbors. And now, of course, everyone will think for a long time to come that is the case. I think the other aspect here is, quite clearly, the Russian state, as I said, is actually not quite as strong as people might think. And that, whether we think of palace coups or other ways, it's not even inconceivable that there could be something like the conditions for Russian civil war if this goes very, very wrong, because the factions within the Kremlin will not be united. They may be united for the moment because they're, at the beginning of this campaign. But if the campaign goes spectacularly wrong from their point of view, and there are heavy losses amongst Russian soldiers, that there could be the conditions for very serious tensions within Russia, and indeed all the other threats that Peter's already mentioned.
So, I mean, on this question of the Russian threat, whether or not Russia is sustainable as a state, in the coming decades, right now where we are, they're invading a European country.
They're acting very aggressively. You know, Russia's recently changed its nuclear stance to a much more aggressive position. You know, what should we be doing?
Well, I think we should be avoiding escalation at all costs. You know, the idea that we could have a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which would mean having to shoot down Russian jets, I think would take us very much to the brink of nuclear war, which we've been trying to avoid since 1945, you know, at the least. So the first thing has to be de-escalation, coupled, of course, with, you know, a ceasefire in Ukraine to end this absolutely appalling war that is entirely Putin's choice. And those two things need to happen concurrently. Any overt Western intervention that challenges directly the Russian military will be seen as a threat, as Peter said. That's the conception of security, that there are threats and dangers, and they have to be confronted. And I think it's grossly irresponsible on the part of a number of politicians to even raise the prospect of a no-fly zone.
It's extraordinary, though.
Absolutely extraordinary. No lessons have been learned from the worst of the Cold War.
No, I think, and I personally could do with a bit less moralizing. If people are as up, I hate war, as I no doubt all of us around this table do, and I hate aggressive invasions unjustified by international law. And I apply that to a lot of events in the past few years, some of them conducted by my own country, thinking particularly of the intervention in Libya, which has been nothing but disastrous. And one also recalls the NATO bombing of Belgrade, which I think is still an extremely dubious event, and the Iraq war. We should be perhaps less self-righteous about it and more anxious just to try and find some way of ending the horror of war as soon as we can. But I completely agree that people who speak of a no-fly zone. How can anybody so completely unable to understand war be in any position of importance in public life? It's just amazing to me that anybody could say anything so stupid. And if it didn't lead to a nuclear war, the possibility of a general European conventional war is so terrifying that anything should be done to avoid it. And remember, by the way, another development in this it will become apparent, is that Belarus has more or less ceased to exist as an independent country and is now part of Russia. So Russia now has another border with NATO directly through Belarus with Poland. So again, the possibilities of disaster if any attempt were made to try and shoot down the Russian Air Force and only the United States has the power to do that anyway, is just appalling. Do people actually want a general European conventional war? Do people think conventional war is that much better than nuclear war? Because they will find that modern conventional munitions are in many cases very nearly as destructive as nuclear ones.
So I mean, the next question then, if we shouldn't be considering military action, is what are the other options? So we've seen some quite aggressive sanctions coming out recently. Now, there have been a lot of sanctions for Russia, and I think there's a question, is this going to seriously frustrate Putin? How much is it going to hurt ordinary Russians? We've also seen suggestion from, you know, Tom Tugendhat that, amongst others, that, you know, Russian school children should be sent home. I mean, how far do we go?
Well, this is verging on hysteria, isn't it? But in sanctions in general, and look at their record in Iraq, where they destroyed a largely pro-Western middle class, in Iran, where they are busy doing the same thing, and also where they also savage the poor. It will not be Mr. and Mrs. Oligarch in their vast dacha outside Moscow or their penthouse apartment who will suffer from sanctions. It will be Igor and Irina in the back streets of Chelyabinsk who are going to suffer from sanctions. I wish we would stop reaching for sanctions as a pretense of doing something when we know that we can't. I think it will have no impact whatever on the outcome of events, but it will make life much harder for people who've played no part in taking this decision and whose fault it isn't, and will increase bitterness and misery in a way which can't conceivably aid the search for peace.
It's very clear that sanctions, you know, have been seen as somehow, you know, a panacea when they clearly aren't. At the same time, how do we confront and also contain what is a threat now, not just to Ukraine, but possibly to other countries? That's the question. During the Cold War, what was interesting is that we had clearer red lines. There was grudging respect between the leaderships of each side. There wasn't the endless demonization, even if words like evil empire or, you know, American imperialism were often spoken. But certainly there seemed to have been some understanding that after the horrors of World War II and then the agreement in Helsinki, nuclear warfare was off the table. Conventional warfare was off the table. There were proxy wars, but that's probably as far as it went. We're now in a much, much more dangerous situation where the red lines are neither clearly defined nor really ever properly enforced, where there's mutual demonization. There is absolutely no trust whatsoever, just the opposite. There's deep, deep suspicion. And we are essentially treating, countries like Russia, and we could say the same about China and others, as a monolith, as if somehow it's one thing. It's one essentialist thing that we can reduce to Putin's leadership or Xi Jinping's leadership or the mullahs in Iran. Because, of course, we're dealing with a vastly complex country with very different facets. And absolutely, the question is not the people of Russia. The question is surely the political system. And it's very hard, as we know, ever to change a political system from the outside. It's not really been done very successfully at all, except after World War II, when Germany and Japan and indeed Italy were rebuilt. And partly because of Marshall Plan type aid, and partly because there were some institutions there that could be salvaged from the wreckage of that conflict. It's very hard to see how, you know, Russia evolves in a direction that isn't authoritarian in the way that it's now happened for 20 years. But we clearly need to find a way to reach out to the Russian people.
What is
that they can essentially build a society that they deserve and not be, you know, faced with that system and indeed have sanctions for the next 30 years. Because it could be like South Africa, a total pariah state for a very long time. And that is a worrying scenario.
Or like Iran, not only a pariah state, which nobody goes, nobody can go. There's limited and almost non-existent diplomatic traffic, miserable intelligence knowledge. We know nothing of what's going on there. And totally cut off, which of course creates a considerable state of danger. Hasn't worked with Iran, it seems to me, in making life more peaceful, cutting it off like that. And I doubt it'll work with Russia. What would our aim be? What is our principle here? If we believe so strongly that we should defy the desires of major states about what goes on next door to them, I'll be interested to see what happens if Taiwan turns up in Brussels and asks for NATO membership. We don't even recognize it as a country because we're so scared of China. We pretend to have a principle in this matter, and we don't. We pretend to be so macho about Ukraine, but in fact we put Ukraine in a position where it gets attacked by a lunatic, and then we stand aside and say, well, we can send you some aid, but you must understand there's nothing else we can do, which we knew before this began would be the position. This is extraordinary. It's a big mouth, tiny fist aspect to Western policy in this, which I find particularly repulsive when combined with so much braggadocio and swaggering. You can't swagger while doing nothing, it seems to me. That nothing is what we have condemned ourselves to do by the policies that we have, because we can't introduce a no-fly zone, because if we do, then you get a general European war. Well, nobody wins that.
And the tragedy for Ukraine is that the longer it resists, the more it will bleed, the more people will be killed, the more the country will be destroyed. And yet, of course, people, you know, in Ukraine and elsewhere are hoping that their resistance continues so that the Russian aggression is confronted and hopefully further, you know, invasions are dissuaded. But we don't know that. And it's absolutely heartbreaking that, you know, Ukraine, you know, much of Ukraine may be sacrificed to that impotence. Because we simply don't have any other ways, because we essentially shut down, you know, any other avenue for the moment. And that is, you know, that again raises a terrifying prospect.
What was our policy in Ukraine? What did we want to achieve? Because whatever it was, we certainly haven't achieved it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm interested just to pick up on one remark you made, Peter, that Putin is a lunatic. Now, do you think that that's true, that he's acting irrationally?
Yes. I think I'm one of a number of people who had thought that he was a sinister tyrant and a profoundly unpleasant person, a ruler much to be said against him, but was a calculating and, in fact, surprisingly cautious one. Remembers the response to the extraordinary event we haven't discussed, the great putsch in Kiev of 2014, was actually surprisingly limited and cautious. And he allowed the impression to be given that he himself had not even been that keen on annexing Crimea, but had done so because it was something which really he felt there was no alternative at the time to do. And now, obviously, those actions were illegal, but they were restrained, cautious, and they were chess players' actions. With some consciousness of what the responses to them might be and how you respond to them. The war on Ukraine, when I woke that morning to the news that it had begun, my jaw just dropped. It didn't fit with anything that I'd previously known or thought, and it made no sense in terms of the Putin that we previously knew. I think it's a mad action. I just think it's crazy, and I think we see it here in democratic countries that after a while, leaders in democratic countries become detached from reality. But I think in the Kremlin, and I think people have pointed out that during the isolation of COVID and all the rest of it, I think it may well be that he's passed through the line. I don't wish to use terms like this, and I generally disapprove of long range psychiatry. But I just think the action is so crazy that it's legitimate to call him a lunatic.
I think there have been so many inflection points over the last 10, 15 years, and probably the single biggest one of them was the Iraq War, when, having had this brief interlude of, the war on terror and, Russia being on the same side as it was fighting its own insurgency, had done so in Chechnya, was facing it on its southern border. And now, with Afghanistan and so on, we were all on the same page. Islamic terrorism needed to be defeated, and that was sort of a common that was a common basis for cooperation. But after Iraq, of course, we basically started seeing this incredible divergence. So, Russia, alongside with France and Germany, opposed it. Then we had the color revolutions and, a long series of events that essentially pointed in the same direction, which is divergence, increasing conflict, and then, open warfare. And it's happened sporadically, Georgia 2008, in the Donbass and so on. And whatever the circumstantial reasons may have been, I think, as Putin outlined very clearly in 2007 at the security conference in Munich, he wasn't going to accept what the West was offering, and he was going to increasingly challenge it. And I think this is a intensification of something that's been in the making for a good 15 years.
And isn't it fascinating that the response of the West, this was not to say, oh, that's interesting, maybe we should talk about this, but to announce the following year at the Bucharest NATO summit that we were inviting Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO. Some people might have seen that as being a bit of a provocation.
But it's also really tragic for those countries because they're left in this grey zone. On the one hand, they're sort of, the carrot is being dangled of future membership, but nothing's being done. So they're basically then left to their own devices when Russian aggression happens, as it did in 2008, and it's of course happening now on a horrific scale in Ukraine. And that's simply not a principled policy.
Well, it was actually Georgia that started fighting in 2008. But leaving that aside, the problem with it is that what we did was we pushed Georgia and Ukraine up over the top out of the trench and said, hey, you go on, go ahead. We'll look after you. And of course, we didn't. And the proper way to express leadership is not get out there and go over the top, guys. It's follow me, isn't it?
I think we're talking here about kind of a dearth of strategic vision in the West. That after the Cold War, no one was quite sure what the NATO alliance was for. So is there a sense that we're just seeing inertia here, that people no longer know what NEST and foreign policy is for, what its goals are, what it's trying to secure?
I thought NATO would close down when the Cold War ended. And when it didn't close down, I thought, well, you can understand why this large bureaucracy sitting in Brussels wants to keep itself alive. You know, people's jobs and pensions are at stake. Who can blame them for trying to keep their justification going? But it since seemed to me that I was far too naive in thinking that I should have been aware of the, of the way in which this unfolded with the Wolfowitz approach, that, that somehow or other Russia must be contending. We haven't either mentioned the various failed opportunities to make some kind of accommodation between Russia and NATO, some sort of country membership or whatever it was, and similarly with the European Union. One of my favorite locations in Moscow used to be up near Smolensk Square is a cafe called the Cafe Schengen. They went to it was founded by people who resented greatly the fact they could not travel in Europe. They wanted to be part of Western Europe and to be accepted as Europeans. I mean, this is a very common Russian desire. That's what it was there for. And there was a time when Russians thought they might get some sort of associate membership for both bodies, and it was actually discussed. And it very rapidly turned out to be true. And my own suspicion about this is that none of these European bodies can have Russia in, because they have to revolve around Germany. And the admission of Russia into them would completely overbalance them, and they would utterly change their nature. But the European Union is one thing. Its continued existence is obviously completely rational and has no necessary strategic implications for Russia. But the continued existence of NATO is a puzzle. We do not anymore maintain, as far as I know, any alliances against the Ottoman Empire or the Austro-Hungarian Empire, because they have gone. And maybe there's some office somewhere. I know there's still a Nasserite party in Cairo, which gets government subsidies, but things do hang over. But it is weird to continue to maintain an alliance against a country which no longer exists.
I think just as Russia has its own security concerns, you know, stemming from its history of being invaded, the same is true for other countries in Europe. I mean, whether it's the Baltic states or Poland or other countries, I mean, that fear of either the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union clearly persists. The question then is, how do you resolve it? So it's not to say there aren't legitimate security concerns, you know, everywhere. It's, is NATO the best, way of building European security architecture, to which the answer probably is it may be a necessary but certainly not a sufficient part. You know, what happened to the Paris Agreement that everyone signed? We now mention Budapest and the guarantees of an independent Ukraine, and rightly so, that was signed by everyone. But we also had the Paris Charter, and that Paris Charter, both in its spirit as well as the letter of it, has not been embraced. And I think there are lots of reasons for why that's the case. One fundamental reason is, continuously, Russia is the other. It's always the power that somehow isn't really European, though it is. It doesn't really fit in, though geographically it's at the heart of the European Eurasian continent. And that sort of strange thing of saying, well, Russia is not really like us, and therefore it can't really be part of us, I think has also led to the situation where there's simply no grounds for building anything in common. NATO hasn't done it. The EU hasn't done it. We haven't collectively invented anything that would reflect this. And I think Russia has also, you know, often decided that it just, in the end, doesn't really want to be a part of it and prefers to be a Eurasian power that is neither aligned with the West nor with Asia.
I'm not sure that's true. I think Schengen illustrates rather a strong desire otherwise, but a tiny bit of mischief here. Yes, indeed, the Baltic states have been menaced by the Soviet Union and used to belong to the Russian Empire. Poland, likewise, and lots of other countries in Central and Eastern Europe have the same story. But almost all these countries are also menaced by Germany. And this is extraordinary how we've managed to somehow or other both forget and contain the problem of German expansion and of German menace to its smaller neighbours. And yet we still have uncontained and unmanaged the supposed Russian menace. And my own view for a long time has been that the European Union is the continuation of Germany by other means. And a very polite way of doing, you'll be familiar with this wonderful passage in Alan Toussaint's The Deluge about Richard von Kuhlmann's policy of limited sovereignty in Eastern Europe, of placing a bomb under the Russian Empire by encouraging a sort of limited nationalism in the colonized states of the Russian Empire, which then leave Russian control and actually come into the German sphere of influence as ostensibly independent states, which aren't, which seems a very recognizable format to me. If the Russians had only thought of that, we might be living in a different Europe, mightn't we?
Well, I certainly agree that Germany had that, you know, had that power and was a, you know, much greater threat for much of the 20th century, first half of the 20th century. But then the fundamental difference is once Nazi Germany was comprehensively defeated by all, with the very significant contribution from the Soviet Union, as we know, with, you know, 28 million people, you know, with 28 million people dying in that fight against the Nazis, Germany did change fundamentally for the reasons, you know, you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You know, we actually were able to build the rule of law, have a proper constitution, federalism, so on. Mm-hmm. Everything that essentially managed to defuse and defeat Prussian militarism and everything associated with it. The same thing has not quite happened in Russia after the end of the Soviet Union. Elements, definitely, but other elements did stay in place, whether military or security service or the sort of corrupt, you know, functioning of the economy. It took on very different forms, but some of the fundamental structures of power have not changed. And that, I think, is
partly where it hasn't, but as we were discussing earlier, should have done, yeah. Could have done.
Yeah. Oh, there's nothing inevitable. I mean, I think the contingency of history is so important to remember here. You know, even once we had Iraq and the color revolutions and so on, and as I said, there was this divergence, you know, of course it could have been stopped long before we got to the situation. Nothing is ever absolutely inevitable. But I think the deeper continuities, you know, are now very clear to see. And, you know, Russian aggression towards its neighbors, I'm afraid, has been also constant in the last 10, 15 years.
So I mean, I'm also interested then on this question of history. If we're entering a different phase of history, because, you know, the last 15 years, you know, we've seen a world that's been, in a sense, underwritten by America. It's this sort of post-war order of, you know, going to support capitalist development and national self-determination. But could it be that we're going back to an older world of great power diplomacy? So, I mean, you know, you mentioned, you know, Germany and Russia dividing Eastern Europe up into divergent spheres. Is that what we're seeing? You know, that Russia is simply trying to reassert a sphere of influence, and that perhaps, you know, Germany, which has been a bit slower to introduce sanctions and Nord Stream and all that, may be willing to go along with it in the long run.
Well, I just think we neglect the extraordinary. I'm not in favour of Britain belonging to it, but I've never thought it a foolish organisation, of the extraordinary success of the European Union in recognising that after two attempts by Germany to assert itself quite inevitably, really, as the dominant power in Central and Western Europe, that we found a way in which this could be established peacefully. No such way has been found to establish Russian influence over its sphere peacefully and in a civilized fashion. And it's a pity. And maybe after 1989, 1991, that could have been done. But that's very much the way it seems to me. The whole of the origin of this goes back, as far as I'm concerned, to 1914, in any case, and which began the first of the what we can now say the three great European wars centered upon Ukraine. Ukraine's first emergence as a modern nation comes out of the Peace of Brest-Litovsk in 1918, as basically a German protectorate. That's when there was no modern Ukraine before that. And here's my fascinating historical question of the week, which no one can ever answer except me. Where was Lenin on August the 4th, 1914? Yeah, break of war. Nobody knows. He was in Austria. He was in Austrian Galicia, where he was interned as an illegal alien by the local police force and then sprung by Austro-Hungarian military intelligence in Vienna and put on a train to Zurich. Why was that?
To destabilize the Russian Empire.
Well, you have it as one. And that's what they tried to get. That's what Kerensky tried to get him on in the July days in Petrograd. That he was actually, and had always been, an agent of German powers.
I mean, I think if we were to go back, a lot further in history, then I think two things, you know, might be. Interesting to mention. One is, of course, the Great Schism, which, you know, sort of permanently divided Christendom. But then also what was, you know, the case in the East, people would say, oh, the East was only absolutist and autocratic all the way until, you know, 1991 or something. Well, actually, for some time before the fall of Constantinople in 1453, you had what the Russian historian Dmitry Walensky calls, you know, the Byzantine Commonwealth. You had essentially, you know, this sort of cultural commonwealth of, you know, of Orthodox nations, which was not always just, you know, ruled by, you know, by or from Moscow. It was, you know, it was actually much, much more the sort of, you know, what Burke called a cultural commonwealth. So you had that, but it ended with the fall of Constantinople, and then, you know, increasingly the formation of, you know, more modern states, more centralized, more absolutist, and so on. And yes, the failure for what we now call civil society really to take root and to flourish in those parts. But they weren't also entirely absent, because of course, where did dissidents come from? You know, where, you know, dissidents, you know, at the time of the Tsar, or indeed during Soviet times, there was something like the emergence of associations
let us not forget that a lot of people, when the centenary of the Russian revolutions came around in 2017, including the BBC, seemed to think there'd only been one revolution in 2017, but the people still think that Lenin overthrew the Tsar. But what Lenin overthrew was actually the first genuinely democratic state that had ever existed in Russia. Amazing thing. If you read, I think, again, Tooze gives an account, the extraordinary efficiency and cleanliness of the voting for the Constituent Assembly. And it was that that was surrounded by Lenin and then with bayonets and suppressed. The Russians in 1917 were perfectly capable of beginning a new democratic state, and that was what was destroyed, and we live with the destruction of that. One of the most terrible tragedies of the modern world, forgotten completely. It's not, people in that part of the world are not incapable of being Democrats, and they're not incapable of being free. They just don't get the chance that often.
Yeah, exactly. And there were other constitutional moments, you know, it's Alexander II and other attempts to essentially constitutionalize the whole system, including having a constitutional tsardom, which I still believe, you know, would be a better model, because it would create a sense of national unity, but then also allow for more adversarial politics one level below. Now, that, you know, is very unlikely to happen in the present circumstances, but, you know, I don't think an all-powerful Russian presidency, you know, is a good thing. I think you need a constitutional monarch, and then you have, you know, you begin to develop a parliamentary tradition, of which, again, there were precedents in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Well, I wasn't expecting to end up with bring back the Tsar as our concluding point.
Well, it couldn't have been worse than what we've got, could it? I mean, really.
So any closing remarks?
No, I think I'll leave it at that.
Bring back the Tsar.
I wasn't expecting to get back to the presuming you're thinking of the Romanovs, with the sub-cadet branch you're hoping. But no, I mean, I take your point. And speaking as a desperately nostalgic constitutional monarchist myself, I don't think it even survives here anymore. So I think chances of it in Russia are pretty slim. It something has to be better than what the poor Russians have ended up with. Oh, what the poor Ukrainians have ended up, honestly.
Well, on that note, Adrian, Peter, thank you so much for joining us, and this is all the start.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.